Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:29 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 24th, and being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I think we've got a number of different topics to discuss today. What I hope to cover is a large number of important long-term ratios that may give us some clue as to exactly where markets are going to evolve over the course of the next decade, and putting what's happened in the last 2 or 3 months into some context. Now, I'm fully appreciative that that's a very ambitious goal, so I think there is room for some enlightenment, but also there are going to be more questions asked that we're going to have to wait for some kind of answer to be delivered. But one thing that's for sure is that the number of consistent trends that are still out there in the world has reduced considerably in the last 2 months. We've had an extraordinary pullback, which fulfills the massive reaction against the prevailing trend characteristics, which is a type 2 top formation from the chart seminar. We've had incredible accelerations on the downside, which is a type 1 ending, because sometimes the type 2 top goes down so fast that it turns into a bottoming characteristic. I think we've definitely got some evidence of that in some sectors. But then the question is about recovery, because when we think about where is the epicenter of risk, that's perhaps the biggest question that is outstanding. Because the epicenter of risk is the sector that is least likely to recover and is most likely to move into a lengthy period of consolidation, which could last years and form a type 3 bottoming process, which is defined by ranging time more than anything else and size. In other words, that it is a very lengthy sleeper type of base formation development, which can last for decades in some cases. Those sectors that are furthest away from the epicenter of risk are those that are most likely to recover and lead us going forward. But then we also have to pay attention to the fact that there are some sectors that have been doing spectacularly well for a long time. And it does behoove us to ask, how could those long trends eventually end? Because one of the most important is the bond market. And the total return on US 10-year Treasury futures, if one were to roll over those trades for years at a time, the cumulative total return has been incredibly impressive, going up from the birth of the index in 1981 all the way up to quite recently. It's still hitting new all-time highs. It looked like it was peaking between about 2016 and 18, and then it reasserted on the upside. We have the widest overextension relative to the trend mean we've seen in the context of the entire price series, so it wouldn't be at all surprising that we get at least some consolidation in the near term. But the minimum requirement to confirm that we're back in a supply-dominated environment for bonds would be that it sustains a move below the trend mean, and we are a long way from that still. In other words, there is still in the bond market the clear conclusion that the biggest threat is deflation. So that's certainly something we need to pay attention to. Bond markets are pricing in deflation. And I think that that's the most realistic outlook in the short term. And the short term can be defined as anything out to about 3 months, maybe even 6 months. We've always defined the medium term as anything from 6 months to 2 years, and the long term anything from 2 years to 20 years. So then we got to think about, well, what's going on in the bond markets? Well, obviously we've got this incredibly difficult situation as a result of the coronavirus, and also the additional fact that it is a rolling problem, that it is hitting different countries at different times, We tend to think of it as being real time whenever it hits the country that we're living in, but the reality is it started in China, then it hit Europe, then it hit North America. Now it's moving into other countries. We've got rising cases in Australia, in Latin America, and in Southeast Asia and Africa. It's not going to hit all of those countries at the same time, but it's going to be a rolling problem. And that is one of the biggest challenges because as long as there is a growing number of cases in any one country, that is going to preclude the global economy from getting back to transportation. If, for example, there is a large number of cases in South Africa, how can any country then consider the potential to start flying in and out of South Africa again? Or if Italy is unable to deal with the number of cases that it is going on, well, then how much travel will go in and out of that country? Then, of course, what about the potential that somebody goes from Italy to Switzerland and then flies to somewhere else? Well, obviously, then that is an additional problem. So, as long as we have these growing numbers of cases internationally, then it is going to delay the potential for travel and business to get going once more. And of course, that does have a deflationary outlook, and that's why bonds are so firm. But then we have the additional side, I guess, the medium-term consideration, and it is that the massive quantity of money that is being produced. When we look at the size of the U.S. deficit, it's going to be in the order of about 4 trillion in here this year. And despite the massive amount of money that's been printed over the course of the last decade, 4 trillion is still a lot. And the size of the Fed's balance sheet has gone from 3 trillion and change to 6.5 in the space of a month. And or I guess not quite that much, but certainly it's gone up 3 trillion in or 2.5 trillion in the space of a month. This is larger than in nominal terms. Than we saw in 2008, but in terms of the percentages, not so much. In fact, it's smaller than 2008 when we think about it in terms of the quantity relative to the size of the balance sheet, and therefore it's quite likely that the Fed's balance sheet is going to continue to advance. Now, they are tailoring the size of their purchases to the quantity of fear in the market. So they were buying hundreds of billions a week in the early part of April, and that has been significantly brought back to the only tens of trillions, excuse me, tens of billions on a daily basis. So that is, I think, a clear indication that we've got dynamic movements from the Federal Reserve, but it's a global phenomenon. So when we look at the ECB, then they have lagged in terms of the quantity of money that they are producing, but they are certainly adding additional fuel to the liquidity rally that's underway. And they are likely going to have to do a lot more. Europe has been going nowhere for most of the last 20 years in terms of the stock market. And the Euro Stoxx index did get up to a new all-time high at the end of last year, and it failed to sustain it. It has now come back down and then broken down from the range that persisted for more than 4 years, and now it's struggling to get back up even into that range. Europe has got some very significant challenges, and not least of those is that unemployment is going to surge on the upside when it's reported for the entire Eurozone area, or indeed Europe generally. Unemployment in the Eurozone has averaged about 9.5% over the last 20 years. There have been plenty of occasions when it's been higher, and the occasions when it's been lower than that have been relatively short-lived. Of course, the regions reliance on social democracy with very high taxes and an overbearing influence of government on commercial activity and really quite high taxes on corporations and a total reliance on the export sector rather than the dynamism of the internal economy is they're all compounding in an environment where the global economy is under pressure. Europe needs to come up with an internal growth story. And that's going to be particularly difficult because when we think about multiculturalism is basically a euphemism for racism because it inhibits the integration of immigrant populations into wider society. Masking racism under the guise of giving respect to people's cultures. It has been used as a way of making sure that domestic populations remain separated from immigrant populations for most of the last 50 years. And that has resulted in Balkanism, but also ghettoizing immigrant populations, which is obviously a significant problem in Europe in particular, but it's a problem anywhere multiculturalism has been adopted. In fact, what you're starting to see in Guangzhou, in China, where there is a significant African population, is that there has been no attempt to integrate them into Chinese society. The latent racism within China has started to come out during the coronavirus outbreak. And something that I've certainly seen is at the border crossing between Shenzhen and Hong Kong, I've seen on at least three separate occasions where large groups of African workers who want to cross the border refuse to queue and they simply barge through all the other people that are queuing at the passport control area, and the police do absolutely nothing about it. So on the one hand, there is a that they are seem to be expressing some fear of African consumers and workers. On the other, it's that they are tolerating their existence because of China's geopolitical imperative to try and build bridges with Africa. But again, this is another latent form of racism that they don't demand civility from African workers that come into China because of this multiculturalism that has been adopted. But of course, that doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist, and this is a problem within a lot of societies. Now, when we start to think about where are we then in terms of this wider environment, there has been a massive rise in populism. And Europe in particular has been the country, the region that has adopted austerity more than anywhere else. And it has singularly failed to create economic dynamism. Therefore, it's a failed suite of policies. And it's unlikely that any real doubling down on austerity is going to be adopted. So when we start to think about what is happening in terms of Italy, then the spreads that have been widening, well, it's not a kind of situation like we've seen over the course of the last decade, where spreads have widened out in a very dynamic manner. We are likely to see the ECB step in and provide assistance. So it's unlikely the spread is going to rise above 300 basis points. But that is pretty much missing the point because there is incredible commonality between the rising government bond spreads on Italian, Spanish, Irish, Greek, Portuguese debt relative to bunds. But then there's the additional issue that, in absolute terms, German bund yields have been rising off their lows posted in March. We're moving increasingly towards a pan-European bond issuing body. And that is the ambition of Eurozone in the first place. But it also means that it's extremely unlikely that austerity is going to even raise its head in the Eurozone. And then we look at the success of populist governments, like the Brexit revolution within the UK and the success of President Trump in getting elected in the USA. There are two, I think, particular issues there that we've seen in the UK and the USA, we haven't seen elsewhere, and it is for a large incumbent party to transform itself from the status quo beneficial or the party that has benefited most from the status quo into a populist upstart movement. That's certainly been the case with the Conservatives and their transition to supporting Brexit over the course of the last 4 years. It's also been evident in the success of the Trump administration in bending the entire Republican Party to its sway. That has ensured that those parties are going to survive. Where we haven't yet seen that is in other countries, and it greatly increases the potential that either the incumbent parties are going to have to transition or that we're going to get upstart parties. But the much bigger point is that it is extraordinarily unlikely that any party that comes to power is going to do so on the back of austerity. It means that we're going to have a lot more money printed. That's one of the most important medium-term to longer-term considerations, that the quantity of money printing is going to massively accelerate regardless of what else happens in terms of the markets. And that is particularly beneficial for gold. So the gold price is one of the most consistent trends anywhere. So we have certainly got the consistent trend in the bond market in the short term. But bonds have been rallying and the for years already, and there is nobody thinks that the market is cheap. Gold is still below the peaks in 2011, and it is mildly overbought in the short term. But so far, this has been a pretty orderly consolidation in the region of the peak from back in March. The most important point about gold is that this is a truly global phenomenon. We have gold prices that are rallying in all currencies. And that is not just a short-term phenomenon. We've seen that we've had major breakouts in a large number of currencies, most particularly the commodity producers, but even in currencies that are considered hard currencies, like the Swiss franc, it has pushed on to new high ground. Against the Chinese renminbi, it has also pushed on to new high ground. The pound and the euro are also at new all-time highs. In fact, one of the only currencies where it hasn't been able to push on to new high ground has been against the US dollar. And that's because the dollar has been a store of value for a significant number of global investors over the course of the last few years. The preeminence of the dollar and the dearth of dollars that have been around. There has been a global shortage of dollars, which has boosted its value versus all assets, and gold has not been an exception. But we are now seeing that the Federal Reserve is massively increasing the supply of dollars. Swap lines are up to about 404 billion as of last week. So that is certainly pushing out a lot of dollars into the global economy, and that is affording gold the opportunity to start outperforming in dollars as well. Now, when we look at gold relative to CPI, I think we get some important information. So the peak in 2011 got all the way back to approximate the peak from 1980. There was one week in which gold prices did surge higher, but the peaks were generally quite similar in 2011 to what they were back in the early 1980s. And now gold has broken up and out of its relative CPI, or its base formation relative to CPI. It's found support at the upper side of that base, and now it is improving upon that performance. I think it is more likely than not we are going to see gold pushing on to new high grounds in US dollar terms and in purchasing power parity terms before we see a significant peak, and even then we could see it move substantially higher. That, of course, brings us to thinking about the Dow gold ratio. And I think that's one of the most important that we can really look at, because it's something that I've been concentrating on now for a very long time, because it was so reliable for such a long time. But the reality is that we've had a very significant breakdown, and we've never seen a breakdown like this in the course of a secular bull market. Well, that then has to raise very important questions. When we look at the consistency of the trend, the fact that it had three important peaks, and each of those peaks was higher than the last, that there was on average about 35 years between those peaks, well, that would have suggested that the next big peak would have been in the mid-2030s, but we've had a really important peak in 2018, which is almost exactly mid-cycle. So then the big question is, well, what do we have next? The mid-cycle slowdown before the acceleration was somewhere in the early 1990s, and equities then turned around and really moved in a big way, and gold declined in a big way. The big mid-cycle change was in the 1950s, and the birth of the Nifty 50 then started to really move higher. So the big question then is, rather than gold declining, does the Dow Jones accurately reflect what's going on in the stock market today? Because it's not no longer an industrial index. It's now defined as an index of blue chips whose constituents dominate their respective niches. So it's got insurance companies, banks, consumer staples, consumer discretionary, and then a handful of industrial companies. But is that really the basis of the economic activity? Because when we look at the Nasdaq composite versus gold, then it is still trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner, but it has broken below the trend mean in here this week. So there are two ways to consider this. One, it's that technology is probably most likely to perform well relative to gold, or the technology sector and its outperformance have lagged the underperformance of the Dow Jones. And we're going to have an answer to that particular question in the next couple of weeks. So I think that's one of the rather important questions. Now, then, of course, we can ask, well, does gold accurately reflect the basis for hard money? One of the most important questions over the course of the last, I'd say, 60 years has been the dominance of petrodollars and the basis for economic activity being oil rather than, or I guess the basis for money being oil rather than gold. And there is some rationale for that, since a number of the big producers of oil were recycling their money into US treasuries. And when we look at the performance of oil relative to the Dow, well, or I guess the other way around, the Dow has massively outperformed oil because of the incredible declines we've seen in the oil price, with negative levels on West Texas Intermediate this week. One thing that we can certainly see is that there is a sequence of higher highs over the course of 130 years, but that the length of time between those peaks is not consistent. It can be anything from 23 years to 36 years to 33 years, and arguably the peak that we have right now is 18 years. So there's nothing consistent about the interval. However, it is important to realize that oil really took off in terms of its dominance of the global economy between 1929 and approximately 2000. And its underperformance relative to the market today is because its dominance of the global economy is waning. There is the real potential that we are at the end of the era of internal combustion engines, which lasted for approximately 100 years. And if that's the case, is it really, efficacious to look at these long-term ratios any longer? Is it reasonable to conclude that the relationship between the Dow and oil will continue to reflect economic activity? One thing we certainly know is that oil is still a tax on consumption, and we might be at the peak of the internal combustion engine, but that it's not going to disappear overnight, and that the number of cars that are going to be produced that deploy batteries is going to certainly increase. But the average life of a car is probably around 10 years. So that would suggest that we could be into about 2030 before batteries become the truly dominant part. But the reality is that when we look at the underperformance of oil and the outperformance of I'm trying to remember the ticker that I created for the gold oil ratio. So one thing that we know is that the oil price has massively underperformed. We also know that the very clear indication is that there is continued demand for gold. And when we look at the gold price relative to oil, it's at an incredibly interesting juncture right now because it's at 100 times. Gold prices have never been as high as they are relative to oil. And this is completely different to anything we've seen before. Now, I haven't done this ratio with the long-term price of oil, so we're not going to be able to go back to the early 1900s, but I did look at it earlier on, and the reality is that this does suggest that we are at an interesting point, because gold has massively outperformed and oil prices are at extremely low levels. When we look at the price of oil, and again, I haven't forgotten. I've created so many of these charts in here today that I'm having difficulty remembering all the tickers that I created. This is the price of oil, and on adjusted for CPI, it's right down at the lower side of its range since the early 1970s. I think it is reasonable to conclude that on a short-term basis, the chances are we've seen important lows for the oil market, and that the price of minus $40 seen this week is unlikely to be exceeded. Prices on the futures curve fall down, so that would suggest that we are likely to see the June contract continue to be actively traded, and it's unlikely to sustain a move above $20 in my view. We may even see it go negative again before it eventually matures. But the reality is that the prices we have right now are extremely exaggerated, and it's not like we're not going to have economic activity picking up. We've already seen that some of the bigger oil companies have already bounced, and not least because Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell concentrate more on gas than oil. And they have not declined in the same way as the oil price. What's also particularly interesting is that we have not seen some of the renewable sectors collapse either. And the biggest ETFs looking at solar and wind have all bounced off their lows. The relationship between renewables and oil prices has broken down over the course of the last 4 or 5 months. They are not moving in lockstep with oil any longer because technology's improved enough to ensure that they are capable of performing on their own. And that represents an existential threat to oil and fossil fuels generally, because if these new technologies can deliver energy independence to countries that never had energy independence before, they have every incentive to invest heavily in renewable technology so that they don't have to see money flowing out of the country on a yearly basis. And coupled with the innovation that's happening in solar, in wind, and in batteries, that suggests there's going to be massive investment in additional generating capacity and in power cables. And that is likely to be a global phenomenon, but it's likely to take a significant chunk out of the earnings capacity for oil companies. And we're likely to see a significant shut-in of the most expensive production zones. That's particularly relevant for places like Canada and Brazil and parts of Africa. And it's also likely to be particularly relevant for the shale industry, where a number of these smaller producers are simply going to go bust, and their properties will be taken over by the larger producers who have the scale, heft, and resources to reduce the cost of production. One of the biggest benefits of shale oil is that as soon as you stop drilling, within 2 months, your production starts to decline. So it's possible for shale operations to tailor their supply to the oil price. And that elasticity is not something that conventional wells afford. So we do have an additional elasticity to some of the newer sources of oil that have not existed previously. But that suggests that we're going to be in a ranging environment. Transportation is approximately 40% of all oil use, and with the evolution of batteries and of battery-driven vehicles, then that is something that is likely to eat into the growth potential for oil. The pie is unlikely to get any bigger. And against that background, China has got a geopolitical imperative to close its energy disadvantage relative to the USA in particular. They have got the biggest shale resources in the world, but they are in extremely mountainous areas, which are already prone to massive earthquakes. Therefore, it's probably going to be locked in because of the cost of extraction until either technology improves or prices rise. But China is going to go for massive rollouts of battery technology for its transportation sector and also railroads, because per capita ownership of cars has probably peaked already. and they're never going to get to the car ownership ratios that you have in North America. And India is probably never going to get to the car ownership ratios they have in China. There are simply too many people and too little space to fit all those cars into roads that don't exist yet, or cities that are too congested with current traffic patterns, not a mind more cars. So India and China are much more likely to pioneer public transport and trains rather than cars, as their transportation needs increase with improving standards of living. The outperformance of technology, the outperformance of gold, those are two halves of a big issue. The first is that we know that austerity is completely out of fashion and that governments all over the world are going to be printing money like stink. That's going to devalue their currencies, and gold appreciating in all those currencies is obviously going to represent a very significant factor. It's also particularly beneficial for gold miners, and the gold mining index has been pushing on to new recovery highs relative to gold. Now, when we look at this on a much longer term basis and look all the way back to the 1970s, well, then we're presented with just how much the sector has underperformed since 2003 and the potential that it is now on the cusp of breaking on the upside relative to the gold price. This is a potentially very important development because gold miners have pretty much given up on spending on new mines. That's one of the most important developments that could have influenced investors' decisions. The biggest challenge for any gold investor is to try and find gold at a price that's below spot. And the only way to do that today, in the stock market at least, is to buy gold miners, where they have got a significant margin over the spot price right now. The vast majority are producing in at levels that are below $1,000, and gold prices are in the region of 1,700. And those are the kinds of margins that are enviable in the technology sector. We also have the evolution of technology and the continued outperformance of the Nasdaq 100. That also helps to highlight the fact that there are large companies that dominate their respective industries and have succeeded in monopolizing the benefits from cloud computing and the internet, and they continue to represent relative strength. Because they're capable of growing and because of the strength of their balance sheets, they're also among the companies best placed to continue to benefit from massive provision of liquidity. And the semiconductors index is mirroring that advance because they're piggybacking on the larger companies. We're potentially at a very important point in global markets. We know that oil prices have declined meaningfully. We know that gold has broken on the upside and that bonds have been doing still quite well, but that this is looking like a trend that is long in the tooth. There is the clear potential that we're going to have inflation arising. And the fact that people can make more money from working or from unemployment than they can from working is something that is going to come back and plague economies as we come out of viral lockdowns. The fact that we are now in helicopter money territory, and that is very much in the mold of giving the people what they want. Well, what the people will want is massive wage increases to encourage them back into work. Why on earth would they go back to work when they have been making more money from unemployment than they could from working. And that's particularly true for sectors where people would have been relying on tips, and with less consumer traffic, as consumer sentiment is going to take time to improve, well, that is also going to impact their earnings capability if they go back to work. So why would they do that unless they were guaranteed a higher income? Rising wages and wage demand growth is inherently inflationary. That's what gold is pricing in. That gold is starting to price in an inflationary outcome. The sectors that do best in that kind of environment are clearly the technology sector, because it has the potential to grow faster than the rate of inflation. It also has the potential to deliver the labor-saving devices that companies are going to demand when wages start to rise. So it's when wages rise that companies have to invest in order to deliberately boost productivity. Then, as interest rates rise and as inflationary pressures rise, companies get pricing power back. And that allows them to, the companies that have got strong dividends to perform, because they will still have the potential to deliver dividend growth. And the dividend aristocrats tend to perform particularly well in that kind of environment. But of course, bonds don't. When we think about the where we're in fact going, the massive amount of debt that's been created is eventually going to debilitate the faith in money. And that's why it's important that gold is doing well now. It tells us that this loss of faith in the purchasing power of money is already underway. And it is being masked by the fact that asset prices are continuing to rally. We're not out of the coronavirus problem yet. And the knock-on effect of the devaluation of fiat money is not going to spare the stock market entirely. The fact is that we've had very meaningful declines on the vast majority of indices. And when we look at the S&P 500, for example, it spent about 3 weeks below its 1,000-day moving average. It is now rallying back towards its 200-day moving average. I think it is quite likely we're going to have consolidation. We're going to have at least some ranging below the 1,000-day moving average, below the 200-day moving average and above the 1,000-day moving average. But one chart that I thought was particularly interesting in here today was to look at the S&P on a purchasing power parity basis. And when we look at that on the long term, well, what we're presented with is very clear confirmation that we still have ranges one above another. And that has been a significant factor for a really quite prolonged period of time, that on a purchasing power parity basis, the S&P 500 has been able to find support at progressively higher levels, and has, and on the monthly chart, we don't see the intra-month decline down to 300, but that's where it did find support. We can also see that in 2008, the purchasing power parity of the S&P got all the way down to test the upper side of the underlying range. During the big decline in 1982, it got back to test the upper side of the preceding range. So arguably, we have just seen another one of those major tests. Now, what that suggests is that we are probably in for ranging on the S&P 500, but that it is unlikely to take out the 300-point level on a purchasing power parity basis. And secular bull markets in the past have generally gone up more than we've seen on this occasion. Well, that does suggest that we are probably in for a lot of ranging. We're probably in for more volatility, but that more likely than not that we're going to see additional higher levels on the S&P 500 over the course of the next few years. And it's likely to be benefiting from, in the first instance, the massive quantity of liquidity that's being produced, and in the second instance, the potential for inflation to both deliver purchasing or to deliver pricing power back to companies, but also the vast majority of company debt is fixed, and they'll be able to erode that quantity of debt. The massive quantities of debt that are being created are more than likely going to have to result in some form of new money being created. The massive debts that governments have, that states have, municipals, cities, and have all accrued, and the huge quantity of money that has been promised in terms of pension liabilities, the only way to ever make good on those promises is to devalue the currency. And when we think about the fact that central bank balance sheets have massively increased, well, the reality is that when a central bank owns all of the bonds, then it can just simply cancel them and in one fell swoop change the value of money overnight. I think that's one of the most important points that Ray Dalio has been making, that and a number of other analysts have been talking about the Jubilee moment and thinking about how the big question of the quantity of debt is eventually going to be resolved. So obviously, the biggest parties at risk are the people who own bonds today. They're going to be the ones that are under the most pressure when we get a revaluation point. There is no predicting when that is eventually going to happen, but the faster gold rallies, the closer investors are likely to believe it's coming. We don't yet know how long this recession we're currently in is going to last. The other important point is to monitor what's going on in terms of commodity prices. Wheat prices have got base formation characteristics, but they have not broken out yet. Rough rice is a much more international commodity, and it's the staple food for the majority of the global population, but it was down heavily in here today. So we've got a downside key reversal. There are fears out in the wider world that we're going to have food price inflation later this year because farmers are euthanizing pigs and chickens because they can't afford to feed them. They don't have access to feed. There are bottlenecks in terms of the supply of food that have not filtered down into the wider economy yet, but it's obviously something that we do need to pay attention to. If we get food price inflation, that's obviously something that we need to pay attention to. What I think is particularly relevant as well is to look at the Dow Continuous Commodity Index chart. Gold has surged higher. Oil has surged lower. They're both in the continuous commodity index. If we simply look at that from a longer-term perspective, it has been consolidating above the peak in 1999 for the last 3 years and has rebounded in a meaningful way. That does continue to confirm that stocks are outperforming commodities on aggregate, but that gold is marching to its own beat because there was historically an argument that oil was a petrocurrency, that it was the the basis for money. But that's no longer the case. And if that is no longer the case, it doesn't mean that oil can't rally. Oil prices are very low, but it's not the basis for money any longer. You can't simply print gold into existence. There is no shortage of oil. And in fact, there's a massive oversupply of oil that no longer meets the limited supply argument. So that's one of the inhibiting factors in the persistence of a petrol dollar argument. Therefore, investors are falling back on the efficacy of thinking about gold as hard money. Now, eventually, when we think about where the value is being created in the market, it's in data. And we just don't have a way of looking at data as a store of value. Again, it's very difficult to make a limited supply argument about data because the entire basis for thinking about the importance of data is the fact that it is limitless in terms of its capacity to deliver value as more and more technological innovation is sourced from the interpretation and access to various data sets. So that is likely to form the basis for a secular bull market. The fact that the biotech index is now back at its peak from 2015 following a lengthy hiatus is meaningful, and that really the entire move we've had, it was a spectacular advance in 2011 and through to 2015, and it's probably not much more than a range in the context of a secular bull market. It's worth remembering that the human genome was only first sequenced in the early 2000s, and we're really only now entering the commercialization phase. A number of the vaccines that are being developed for attempting to be developed for the coronavirus are relying on DNA and RNA, and that is something that was completely beyond the realm of the possible even 10 years ago. So these are very significant developments. Also, what we're seeing is the streamlining of the phase 1, phase 2, and 3 are permissioning of new drugs. One thing that is likely to arise from the coronavirus is a much more streamlined view on how to permission new drugs. And that will greatly accelerate the pace of innovation. There is the very clear potential that by the time this bull market in biotechnology eventually does end, a large number of the chronic diseases that inhibit economic growth and productivity will be less influential. And that alone is something that can spark a bull market. We also have the considerable potential that we're going to have innovation in energy, whether that is in the rolling out of better batteries, more efficient solar cells, or indeed the cracking of the fusion energy riddle. Then those are all increasingly more popular as data and analytics become progressively more pervasive in the global economy. Debt obviously is an issue, and it is something that we need to come up with an answer to. We also need to come up with an answer for how better standards of living can be delivered for more people. Globalization has not worked on aggregate. It has certainly worked for the emerging markets. And it hasn't worked for the populations in Europe or North America, who have, in many respects, seen the pace with which their living standards have increased decelerate as a result of globalization and decline for a significant majority, or minority, I should say. one thing that is likely to come out of the evolution of the massive debt problem that we have is debts and obligations are likely to be rationalized, but in their place, we're going to have probably more socialism in terms of medicine and provisions of resources to retirees and public sector employees. That's something that is not so much in the price right now, but we're probably going to have to see inflation first and those kinds of solutions implemented afterwards. Between now and then, we're going to see some deflationary forces, then inflation, and subsequently a paradigm shift in terms of what exactly constitutes money. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.